Yeah, I don't know, man. You ever just feel like life is just catapulting towards some greater purpose?
With bloated ego, we are the only DJ crazy enough to tattoo Jackie Brown on his ass.
This is Michael Mann, and I ride with
Extended Clip.
Welcome to Extended Clip. It is episode 295. I'm one of your hosts, Eddie Averill.
I'm Malcolm Baum.
I'm JT White.
And on today's podcast, we are talking about a Western. When is the last time we talked about a damn Western on this podcast? You know, there was a phase where this was like almost a damn near Western podcast. We were talking about so many of them. It's been so long. And it's also been so long since we talked about a film by Jacques Tourneur, who we talked about his film Stars in My Crown years back, his absolute masterpiece. That was a movie that a couple people have actually told me they didn't know about before the pod and is like a favorite of theirs now. So I like to think that Stars in My Crown, it was a big one for a lot of people, not just me, in discovering the work of Jacques Tourneur. Tourneur was a filmmaker who started out with a kind of like a short film apprenticeship before slowly dipping his toes, getting bigger budgets for real movies across the genre spectrum. You know, he's probably most known for the monster movies that he made, produced by Val Lewton. Producer Val Lewton was very keen on Tourneur's sense of kind of, what lies beneath in terms of horror. You know, the hack thing to say is they didn't even show the cat people, you know. Cat people, they just they just implied it, you know. But I think Tourneur is as atmospheric of a genre filmmaker as you get in the classic era, especially with films like I Walked with a Zombie. But when you also think about films like I Walked with a Zombie, they bring about a certain skepticism of the foundational myths of America, whether or not intentionally. You know, this is Auteur Studies 101. Tourneur's not writing the scripts and sending them to the studios to get approved and then saying, can I direct them too? You know, but this is a director who has a lot of great thematic through lines in his work, thinking about, you know, small town America and the racism and the place that religion holds in Stars in My Crown. And then we think about this one and frontiership and expansion. This is a film that takes place in Oregon. It's a late Western, late 1850s Western in Portland, Oregon, where they got all those Antifa hipsters.
This is kind of about how that whole thing started, actually.
Yeah.
It really is, yeah.
Mob mentality.
It's also like coming 46, so like right immediately after World War II.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think there's a key element here about brutality, yes, versus and wilderness versus civilization that I feel like really comes to the forefront.
And just in terms of what America means, you know, yeah, coming after World War II, it's like, yeah, we were all victorious, just like coming around town bragging about how many Japanese guys we killed, you know? And it's like, well, that's not exactly what we went there for, you know?
Yeah.
Just like in this movie, would we have the, you know, very morally centered protagonist played by Dana Andrews, who talks about how a man can't be hung if there's even a shred of doubt early on in the movie. That's his line. And later on, he reinforces that. But then we see just one provocation leads to a full-on race war over the territories. And it's like, holy shit, we are watching what looks apocalyptic here. And much like the German Expressionist filmmakers after World War I, this is an example of a filmmaker after World War II having seen the brutality and the inhumanity that was capable of being done in Europe in the early 40s, obviously. He then goes back to the history books and shows how we did it to the natives, even the good ones of us, you know, because this isn't like a cavalry movie. This isn't like She Wore a Yellow Ribbon or something like that, where it's like the U.S. military versus the Indians. These are frontiermen who know their place and like communicate better with the natives than the cavalry does. There's like an offhanded line early on. It's like, yeah, the cavalry's going to get eaten up by those native guys. Like, we know not to mess over there, you know, and mm-hmm. they have a nice negotiation about the cabin on their land and the notion of a land for everybody. But then once you build something there, it becomes private. And there is a lot of complications going on in the first hour and 20 minutes of this movie. And it just makes the last 10 minutes of it fucking brutal. Like, the action at the end of this movie, after such a contemplative and thoughtful portrait of Western expansion and seeing the kind of the myths of the Old West being shown partially for what they are. It's not like an expose. It's not a post-Western. This is 1946. But it also still feels a lot more human than the other Westerns of something like 1946. Think about My Darling Clementine, one of my favorite movies ever, a better movie even. But that movie feels like, you know, when it invokes Shakespeare, it feels like it's earned it. And it feels like this is a canonical, mythological story about the shootout at the OK Corral. Whereas Canyon Passage feels like a fiery page of American history. And it reminded me of another Ford Mort. It reminded me of 1939 Technicolor.
Is it She Wore a Yellow Ribbon?
No.
No, wait, that's not.
That's part of the Cavalry Trilogy, which is very related. Yeah.
Yeah. But
Drums Along the Mohawk.
Drums Along the Mohawk. In Drums Along the Mohawk, which, you know, I'd love to revisit that one now that I know a lot more about John Ford and what he was as an exception to the rule in American history. Or American cinema history. But regardless of that whole sidebar, this film is, firstly, more than anything, the first thing you're going to notice is that it's fucking gorgeous. This is a, you know, pretty rare 46 Technicolor effort. And just seeing that Oregon nature, seeing Crater Lake in Technicolor is a sight to behold. And there are parts of this movie where it almost feels a little touristy shooting on vacation, like, but in a good way. You know, Turner is just using these locations, exploiting them for all that he can, just like America may have exploited these locations for all that it could. So, you know, this is like that dialectic of artistry and even forward thinking artistry in Hollywood versus what the Hollywood apparatus was and how it relates to American myths and military. That dialectic is as strong in this movie as almost any classic Hollywood movie, I think. And it's for better and for worse, I think.
She'll be by the river where all heaven be. And there by the river we'll find the trail of beef. Donkey, don't you dare to dally. Can't you hear the killdeer?
What did you guys think about this? You've seen this, right, Malcolm?
Yeah, I feel like I saw this early on, like when I hadn't seen a lot of Westerns, and I kind of didn't realize, you know, how it kind of maybe stood out from Westerns at the time. But, you know, I was just attracted to it because it's just a beautiful movie. Turner, you know, his visuals are always on point. And yeah, I've been on a huge Western kick lately, and kind of like, I don't know, more of like a classic Hollywood kick lately. So I wanted to bring that to the podcast, and just wanted to bring a Turner just because I think he's a major director and someone I've been a fan of, you know, even early on in my cinephilia, watching I Walk with a Zombie. It kind of dispelled the notion of, you know, what I thought older films were like. And Canyon Passage, yeah, you know, just the fact, and there's a lot more of these than you think, but the fact that it's not like, it's set in Oregon and it's like in the woods and, you know, the traditional Western setting of like, you know, a bunch of, what is it, sand, not sand, dirt, you know what I
like
mean?
Like dusty, dirty. Yeah,
dust and dirt, you know.
I have a friend who used to refer to Westerns as dusters, which I always thought was a great...
I couldn't think of dirt, you know. I can only think of sand, which I thought is kind of, you know, just a California mindset, I guess. But yeah, just the opening where we see rain. I feel like you don't see rain a lot in Westerns, and like it's part, we see like the town being built and kind of, you know, Dana Andrews being followed around by like, I forgot who's being followed around by it, but someone who's trying to get his attention, and like there's a lot of mud and whatnot, and it's just great seeing. I don't know, it's just not something you'd usually see in a Western, and that just kind of sets the tone right off the bat that, you know, this is an Oregonian Western, and Turner, you know, milks that for all it's worth.
Dana Andrews is the star of this movie, and I wanted to talk to him. Any of you know like a medium?
Yeah. That'd be a good podcast. Just us trying to communicate with the dead Hollywood
channeling
stars,
old Hollywood celebrities. Yeah,
I wanted to bring up something that Will Sloan said. He said, "Always excited when Dana Andrews is the star of a movie. It usually means I'm about to watch some termite art from a director that the French critics liked. I'm about to fall into the world of mise-en-scène and maybe even late style." Well, it's not late style here for Turner, but I love that as Dana Andrews being the movie star in Hollywood who we associate with, like, camera techniques and staging, which is like, he's not doing any of that shit, you know. It's just we're thinking about the movies that he stars in, and he does have this really great, like, quasi blank palette that's still within the realm of, it can fit into any American genre, you know, but it also is blank enough for the director to really cast their feelings on to the actor's face in a way. And I think the way that Turner directs Dana Andrews here is fantastic, but it's also like, so, you know, you could also give it up for Dana Andrews's range, but I want to talk about how different directors use him. I mean, think about him in Daisy Kenyon by Preminger, and then think about him in Beyond a Reasonable Doubt by Fritz Lang. You know, those are like three performances that are as far away as possible, but then you could also just show me little clips from each of them where he's doing the same standing still dead face kind of thing, you know, or just like his kind of imposing face that he makes, which is barely different than his normal face. But I love Dana Andrews being the star of this because, as I said, it's the perfect movie star for directors to impose their own feelings onto. And I feel like Turner here has such a vivid sense of, like, exploration, romance, and bitter, bitter history, you know? And I feel like the Dana Andrews character is kind of emblematic of all of those.
Yeah, I really love that quote that you brought up from Sloan. I think that this film in general is filled with like a lot of weird sort of side characters or odds and ends. Mm-hmm. I mean, not that Ward Bond is not like a big actor and recurring, but usually only in pretty small or secondary roles. But you get Ward Bond. I love Hoagie Carmichael as the little minstrel with the donkey. And then Andy Devine, who's has the voice where it sounds like he needs like WD-40. There are a lot of like, and not like it's all that uncharacteristic of a Western to be devoted to the story of a town. But this is populated with just like the very beginnings of a town. And within that, I love the little montage of them doing the home building. Yes. In this, I feel like you get a full like sense of all these unique characters there, and just sort of them coming together is a little fun bit.
I think that's wide enough. That's big enough for anybody's fireplace. Here's your other door. You can get out either side in case you have trouble with the Indians or your woman.
Yeah, I feel like that cabin raising montage is really where the film clicks into gear for me. You know, like from that point on, and I want to say that's about the midpoint or maybe a little earlier, but you know, you have that great montage of the cabin being raised and all those roofers getting blocks tossed to them from down below and all this great like action of labor. And then you have the really long shot of them in the background. And then it turns out to just be a more of a medium romantic shot between who is it? It's what's her name? It's George and his wife, who's the partner of Dana Andrews' Logan character, Lucy, right?
Yeah.
Lucy, yeah.
So George and Lucy, whose cabin is being built behind them, are, you know, on this lake having this talk about it. And it's just like such a graceful moment. It reminds me a lot of in Stars in My Crown when the two kids are on the back of the hay bales being pulled along by a wagon, where it's just like this little grace note of people appreciating both nature and what they're making of their lives, you know?
Mm-hmm. And like this, the, you know, with the George and Lucy stuff, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on here. Like JT was talking about, like subplots of small characters that, you know, isn't even kind of like, you know, maybe some of the main themes that we take away from this movie, but just kind of the romantic drama of this feels very, you know, just the characters are a little bit more human and fully formed, you know, it's the women, I should say, than maybe, you know, in your average Western, you know, kind of a, like Lucy kind of seems to have maybe like a Hoxian kind of vibe to her, where she can kind of talk with the boys, you know what I mean? And fit right into that mode. And, or even Caroline, who's kind of more of a traditional character, I don't know, just they're kind of, they're just considered more than your average Western.
Yeah.
And all of that kind of makes the romantic drama of, you know, Dana Andrews' characters, Logan, kind of having a thing for Lucy while at the same time kind of, you know, juggling his expectations with Caroline. It's all done in a very thoughtful way that's just a little bit more fully formed for the time.
Yeah, no, there's that one crazy moment early on where George is giving Lucy like a kiss, like I think shortly after the cabin building. Yeah. And he's like, come on, man, if you're going to do that, you got to really fucking go for it. And then he like takes Lucy and just like is just like passionately just like kissing her in front of him. And he's like, well, yeah, I guess you said you were going to do that. So, yeah.
And George, you know, we haven't revealed this, but George is like stealing from Logan kind of secretly. So kind of, I guess that's kind of a subtext of that scene. It's like, you know, maybe he wouldn't care anyways, but it's just like, you know, that's the gravy train right there. So you kind of have to let it happen, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, that is a wild scene. You know, a lot of guys would be going, couldn't happen to me, you know, while watching. you know, gives a sense of everyone's personality and what, you know, things they might be dealing with.
So yeah, Brian Donlevy plays George, and George is a man with a gambling problem. That's more than stealing from his buddy. It's like, he's running up somehow a $15,000 poker debt in the 1850s. That's like Otani's current bill. Like that's crazy.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is very similar to the Otani translator gambling controversy. Yeah.
Brian Donlevy is Ippe and Dana Andrews is Shohei Otani. Yeah.
And kind of, the Dana Andrews character kind of has like the moral center that we like to think that Shohei has. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. There's something there for the baseball fans.
Exactly.
And, you know, 1940s America, I wouldn't be surprised if Dana Andrews could, you know, throw some nice junk and hit it out of the park, you know? People loved baseball. That was the only sport back then other than college football, you know? So you played football until you graduated college, and then you became a man and played baseball.
And he made the same as, like, the plumber down the street,
yeah,
you know?
Exactly. That's why people always complain. It's like, you can't compare Bill Russell. He was playing against plumbers. And it's like, no, he was playing against guys who got paid like plumbers. They were basketball players. they just happened to have the plumber's hourly rate.
They're actually playing more against guys that are like Dana Andrews, you know? Yeah. Whether that makes them better or worse, I don't know, but that's kind of the more truthful look at the situation.
Yeah, I mean, Gail Goodrich, Dana Andrews, I don't know who would win one-on-one. That's tough. That's tough for me.
I bet Ward Bond could play good defense.
That's true. I bet Ward Bond is a very competitive man in all sports. I bet he played football, honestly. Like, he was in... he's in Salute, John Ford's early military academy movie that has to do, like, is centered around the Army-Navy football game. Ward Bond does have a comedic role in that one. I think maybe his first talking role for Ford. But regardless, Jesus Christ, Boris, what's up, dude? He keeps jumping up and scratching me. You go to your mom. You can bother her.
Eddie's kids vying for attention. Yeah. He can't.
Yeah.
No, tough luck, kid. Eddie's about to do it with the baby carrier.
Yeah, the papoose. Yeah.
You need one of those for Boris.
The cat papoose.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day, they would have called that the pussy papoose. But nowadays, with PC culture, you can't call a cat a pussy cat anymore. I remember when we were younger, my mom had a light switch that had a cat, and it was eating out of a bowl, but the bowl said pussy on it. And I don't think my mom realized how insane that was. And then one day I came in, and she had taken a Sharpie. Yeah.
The realization is hilarious.
Oh, man, that's awesome, yeah.
I can't have my son learning about pussy. Who knows what happens
back to the
that.
Movie. As we said, George, played by Brian Don Levy, is the one who eventually gets involved with his real business partner, Lucy, played by Susan Hayward. And Malcolm, you alluded to Hawks. And yeah, I think that's a great comparison there, with Susan being the more masculine type woman character who is just as valuable in terms of labor as any of the men. We also have Patricia Rock as Caroline, the woman that Dana Andrews gets involved with. Ward Bond's character is named Honey Bragg. He is the gambler who gets in a little kerfuffle with Dana Andrews early on and becomes the antagonist and the big boss of the movie, if you will. And as we said, Hoagie Carmichael fills in the I don't know what you would even call it, the genre panoply, because it's a romance, it's a Western, it's like it has so much action, and it also has Hoagie Carmichael walking around singing some songs with his fiddle. You know, it's nice, it's cute. I heard they named the sandwich after him. Okay, that's stupid.
No, his full name, he's like a...
full name is Submarine Carmichael?
No, it's Hoagland. Hoagland Carmichael.
That should, okay.
They don't make guys like that anymore.
Like, if you get like a 13-inch sandwich, that should be a Hoagland. And then like the shorty roll from Wawa is a Hoagland. But I really like the lightness that Hoagie Carmichael's character brings to it. It's like, again, goes back to that dialectic of how dark this is when you think about the implications historically and what American history is really all about, and the fact that we have this pristine Hollywoodification of it, and the fact that it is great. Like, it's like that's an easy thing to complain about, that you have the Hollywood sanitization of something so brutal, but then you have to actually weigh those things when the film is as moving as this and as beautiful as this. And Turner isn't just like reinforcing what we learned in, you know, eighth grade history. I feel like even for a film in 1946, it's definitely giving you a lot of brutality, especially later on, as we said, to kind of recall westward expansion as America's version of the world wars, you know, the worst atrocities that America can think of either committing or being committed upon.
Yeah, I mean, especially because it's like, you have the Ward Bond introduced from the beginning is a very obvious heavy there who's trying to just like very explicitly trying to rob Dana Andrews.
Yeah.
But just the fact that Don Levy is like doing it behind his back and is like a buddy, like a friend of his, just adds like all the more sinister quality to it. Mm-hmm. And the way it sort of comes out with Hoagie Carmichael, just who the very innocent character of him puttering around with a donkey, just sort of peering through the window, finding it, is like a very silly, naive way to, like, I don't know, get at like the heart of there being something darker here. And I think that even obviously Ward Bond's character is more like explicitly maniacal, There are bits that obviously you can't show in a 40s movie, but when he encounters the Native American woman swimming, and there's just the, like, we allied in time there, what happens? That's just so, like, disgusting and just horrifying.
So to set up kind of all the parts of the narrative, and I will say the narrative is assembled in a strange structural way. Like, it's not... I feel like the WB or the Universal script supervisor guys or whatever, whoever was doing the coverage on this, was like, all right, man, it's out there. You know, you got a lot of crazy stuff, but all right. Like, it just doesn't really, scene to scene, it doesn't have the typical Hollywood dramaturgy. It's like throwing in subplots, introducing them. Not randomly, but surprisingly. And then it's just it's a very strong narrative for a 1946 Western is what I'm getting at here, because mm-hmm. we often associate the later Westerns with being the more thought-provoking ones and the ones that challenge the structures of Westerns, because that was the most popular genre in all of fiction for the first half of the 20th century, right? And so I feel like Canyon Passage, alongside stuff like My Darling Clementine, is predating the 50s Westerns that we would call more thoughtful, such as, you know, the later Hawks and later Bud Bedeker and later John Ford films. And I feel like the darkness is absolutely there despite the Technicolor glow, and it's just such a crazy dynamic. I mean, early on when they're riding into town, you get some amazing silhouette work in broad daylight. It's like such a weird feat of Technicolor cinematography. I don't know how they fucking pulled it off. Like, they're running through the shadows, but behind them is just like the most vivid greens and blues of Crater Lake and the surrounding trees. And it's, you know, you can't replicate that with not just digital. You can't replicate that with other film processing techniques. That is a Technicolor exclusive image right there, you know. Mm. And I feel like Turner is really exploiting the Technicolor form here. If you're watching the credits, it's like there's like five directors on this. Not directors, but there's like the Technicolor director and the script director. Like, the credit breakdown was a little strange to me, and a lot of technical people involved with the cinematography and color design, or color processing. And so I feel like to use this film as like an aesthetic experiment almost is so strange to me because of how heavy the drama is. And it's just one of those perfect Hollywood confluences, bringing those two things together.
Yeah. One moment in that where I feel like the beauty and ugliness really, like, fully comes out for me, the sort of, I guess, yeah, the bar fight that Dan Andrews and Ward Bond have, where Ward Bond is just like the most disgusting sweat covered man, but it looks so, like, the lighting in that and just the Technicolor in general just like makes it look so gorgeous. Yeah. Like, he has like just intense 5 o'clock shadow, just dripping buckets. Yeah, and
the,
like,
the top of his head is just blood. Like, yeah, the blood coming out of the top of his head is one of the more gruesome images I can think of in classic Hollywood terms. Like, that's a hardcore image. That's like on the level of, you know, 99 River Street or the other ones we've talked about is like the most brutal classic era stuff we've seen. Before the bar fight, we also get the great line that George says. He's like, you know, my problem is that I always feel lucky. He's a gambling addict. What can you do?
Mm-hmm. Now, and like, to speak on the cinematography, like the beauty, like, I kind of love how he approaches kind of like earlier travel scenes, like, mm-hmm. getting like kind of one perfect frame, you know, kind of like almost painting like images, and kind of just dissolve, you know, has the characters kind of move within frame within him, keeping his camera still. And we, you know, he kind of just dissolves them into each other. And it's just, it's very impressive just to see like almost a shot after shot of this like travel montage. And yeah, it's very interesting because it is like, I'm sure they were very conscious of that. I mean, as you saw in the credits, there was a lot of people working on that aspect to kind of, you know, make it so beautiful. And of course, Turner, you know, upends it with like, you know, the real history, you know, this is what really went down, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Because it kind of matches with, I think also Turner goes out of his way to like, show it's like the majority of this community like had good intentions, right? Like, they were approaching it like the most correct way you could approach it, you know, with talking to the local Native Americans and, like, you know, making sure they're not overstepping their bounds and whatnot. But it shows that, you know, the reality of this situation, it just takes, you know, one bad guy like Ward Bond to kind of completely ruin this society that they're building up. And it's kind of interesting because I feel like the Dana Andrews character is very much like a director stand-in character, and kind of, you know, he's always talking about, like, I'm gonna leave, like, I'm not staying here, like, you know, I'm gonna hit the road. And he's kind of just like an observer of this community coming together. And it kind of, like, the conclusion, maybe this isn't what Turner's trying to say or whatever, but, like, the conclusion is kind of like, go your own way. Just, you know, the maybe less so that, but just more like, there's, in building a community, a society, there's just a lot of issues that might pop up. And, you know, maybe Tourneur's a little bit more comfortable getting on his high horse and kind of riding away from it.
To speak more on the visual style also, it's like, so yeah, Malcolm, as you said, there's these still shots in the traveling that it really is like beautiful travelogue kind of tourism type footage. And then it's interspersed with the actual drama. And then you get, like, once in a while, these crazy kind of subjective shots, like the cabin raising starts with a crazy shot, like a close up on a tree trunk about to get chopped down. You see it fall down and then everyone framed around it on the sides and everything like that. And it's like such a crazy camera technique that reminds me a lot more of, like, someone like Hitchcock with its subjective angle compared to literally everything else in classic Hollywood at the time, you know. So as we said, yeah, George is skimming from the biz, you know, being involved with Logan's business partner, and that is obviously a very fraught relationship. And we see some kind of flirtatious dialogue between Logan and Lucy early on too, and it's clear that despite them working together, like, professionally, there is something beyond, you know, the tension there. And then we see that kind of flare up throughout the movie. We have the struggle of expansion, and, you know, so it's like, yeah, we have a crime story, a classic Western story, and a romance story all together. Yeah, so this crazy, you know, bar fight, you know, they've had a couple bar fights, but around the midpoint, you know, Ward Bond and Dana Andrews find themselves in the saloon alone, and one of my favorite shots is, like, the shadows of all the spectators on the ground at the front of the frame. You know, you don't even, it makes it look like everyone is out of the bar, just outside looking in at the bar, and we're just like them, you know. And I really love that approach. And, you know, it's crazy how hard Dana Andrews beats on him, but then they're just like, you could have killed him.
Yeah.
You know? And mm-hmm. Goes back to that first thing he said, you know, can't hang a man if there's any doubt. He should not have had doubts about Ward Bond. That was an evil man right there.
It's interesting because, again, it's like this dichotomy he's sort of establishing where it's like this lovely, like, community building. People are coming in with such, like, wholesome, like, pure intentions of, like, living together, living alongside. I mean, again, in as much of a way as that can be pure intentioned in the 40s depicting the 1800s. Yeah. But, like, that there's that, but it's just so much just on a razor's edge that, like, the slightest bit of, like, violence, like, just bloodlust comes out, and everyone's like just ready to, like, fully indulge in this wild, like, animal instinct for mm-hmm. blood.
It reminds me a lot because you mentioned German filmmakers, I think with you know, German expressionism with Tourneur, it's like, it reminds me a lot of Fritz Lang. Like, you think of scenes like in M, and, like, we kind of have, like, a community trial scene, or even Fury, which is, like, explicitly about kind of, like, the dangers of, like, mob mentality and whatnot. And it seems like Tourneur has those same exact kind of issues on his mind. It seemed like Lang and Tourneur were kind of connected there.
Oh, yeah, no, he got a contract in 1934 based on his French work in 1931. So, hey, that's interesting.
Just for the love of the game.
Just for the love of the fucking game, you know? That's also crazy to consider, just that he's a European dude who had to watch all of that go down from stateside. You know?
Yeah.
That's crazy. There's also a scene where, Logan and Caroline, his new beau, are walking around town before Logan is supposed to take his San Francisco trip. And the color in that scene, it's like the whole cinematography of that scene looks so much different. It looks like it's a different film stock and grain style and everything. And the colors are just fucking insane. This orange hue running through it. And I don't know, man. I just think that this is such a stylistic just running the table of anything you can do with style in color in 1946. The third act kind of starts here with, this little prep for the San Francisco trip, and then they finally head out, and Ward Bond follows them, and in the woods starts a shootout, and the shootout between Dana Andrews and Ward Bond in the woods is played beautifully with very long shots with so much greenery in front of them. There's so many shots in that like forest set piece that are just like the characters take up 1/50th of the frame, you know? And it's like the bottom corner too. It's like he puts the horizon line at the very bottom to extenuate how fucking tall all of the forestry is and how small we are as people having these crazy conflicts over said land that is so large. But, you know, Ward Bond can't get a shot off, so he goes dirty. This is the point where Ward Bond goes from being, like, the bad guy to, like, the most evil guy ever. So first, because he can't shoot fucking Dana Andrews or his girl, he shoots their horses to get away. And then he hears the giggling and frolicking of two Native American girls naked taking a bath in the river. And, you know, he does the, well, appropriate for a film like this version of a Tex Avery Wolf animation, you know, like he just turns it on in his eyes. And I love the way that Turner frames him. I mean, there's a shot in that chase during the shootout where he's like framed by these red orangish flowers, and it's a very like kind of pretty framing that reminds me of like Varda's Le Bonheur, you know, and but it's like in the middle of this horribly violent thing. And yeah. I love that it's almost like Malick in The Thin Red Line showing the nature amongst all of the chaos, you know, whenever Malick would show, a close up of a blade of grass or like a bird being born or whatever in that movie. I feel like this has a tiny taste of that in the way that Turner surrounds Ward Bond's character with this godly earthly beauty. Yeah. You know, I just find that such a fascinating dynamic.
Nature is not at fault, you know. It's not it's not nature's fault that Ward Bond is a bad guy, you know. The lush Oregon greeneries are still going to shine through even if some ugly deeds are being
And
done.
I think the natural beauty just like heightens the ugliness of his actions there.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Turner knew what he was doing right away with this character, how he was going to present him visually, and it's fucking sick. Then we get also to go back to the George plot with his debts, kind of circle back to this a little bit before we get the crazy climax where Dana Andrews had given him some money to pay back his debts, right? His poker debts. He just pockets it and goes to play because he sees that the guys in his poker game are all drunk right now. And one of them is drunk and just like putting his face in a lake. And he's like, well, I mean, this is like taking candy from a baby, right? You know? Mm-hmm. So he loses anyway, and he uses the gold of the guy who he killed, too, and that ends up being the smoking gun. But the thing is, it's like this super old-time Americana idea of them having court in the bar, you know? And it's just all the people of the town speaking their mind. And it's such like a antiquated old time idea that goes up against the, you know, modernization that they're looking for. You know, like the characters reference going to New York or Boston and eating in a fancy restaurant with musicians playing and stuff like that. You know, it's not like if we're in a Western, the city life doesn't exist, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I feel like the primal aspect of that is a really great, like, comedic beat, but also thematically very appropriate for the film.
And like I feel like that's a great scene because we see kind of Dana Andrews, you know, the sense of morality it's put to the test, to the, you know, in a very ultimate way where you have a mob of people calling for the death of his friend, basically, for stealing. And it's just kind of, it's just kind of the classic of, like, you know, you say you believe this, but when everything's put to the test, what are you going to actually believe, and kind of the powerful sway of everything. And I mean, even the movie calls into question. It's like, is this mentality even right? You know, as you said, with like the Ward Bond character, it's like, maybe that guy should have got taken care of earlier.
Yeah.
that's kind of the difficulty of living in a society and making these judgments. It's, you know, it's no fun. No one wants to do that.
I think the ending also speaks to the efficiency of Hollywood storytelling too, even if I was saying the script feels a lot looser and, you know, thrown together with plot beats than a usual like 90-minute Hollywood movie, because, you know, you're looking at the runtime, you know, you're in the last reel if you're in the theater, you know, and they're doing the kangaroo court at the bar, and you're like, all right, this is the last beat of the movie, right? You're like, wait, where was Ward Bond again? Oh, yeah. So someone comes in and is like, yeah, the Indians are burning down everything down the line. Like, we're fucked, you know? And it recalls all of the horrifyingly racist Westerns you've seen before. But in this one, it's, you know, logically justified through the plot of Ward Bond being, you know, the evilest of them all, really. So Ward Bond doing what he did, implied, you know, and they say he killed those two girls. A character says he kills those two girls. I think it's implied he did something else first, probably, which, you know, you just see that in his eyes.
Yeah.
Which is just, as we said, horrifying. Like, Ward Bond, sometimes he's the coolest guy ever. Like, in a Ford movie, if he's like...
Yeah, he's one of the buddies.
If he's like just a guy on the wagon train or like the bartender or something like that in a Ford movie, he's the homie. Like, he is so good at being just like one of the most affable type dudes ever. And then he just plays it so fucking evil here. Similar to another Ford, Walter Brennan, in My Darling Clementine.
Yeah.
The local natives are on the attack after this, and they start with burning down the cabin. And then there's a series of attacks that are essentially shown as if they were horror movies, scenes in horror movies, like proto, you know, fucking slasher kills almost. Like, you just see the native person set up, you see the unsuspecting white, and then you see death right after. And it's like 1-1-1, like right after each other. Mm-hmm. The best of them being the dude up in the trees with the flaming arrow.
Oh, yeah.
One of the cruelest kills I've ever seen in a classic Hollywood movie, where he shoots his arrow at a wagon with a family, and we just see these little boys burned alive. It's insane. Yeah. And so, like, you can, there's the on the surface read of looking at that and seeing the depiction of violence by natives toward white people, and seeing, oh, this is just what we learned in our history books, that the savages were around the corner at every moment, you know, and we didn't know when they were going to strike. But it's the context, you know, and it's the way that Turner portrays them in the first half of the movie that makes it make sense, because we have that negotiation over the land too, where they secede, them building a cabin there. They're like, we don't want you to, but, you know, we'll walk away, because you guys have respect for the land like we do. And then they are so horrified by what Ward Bond did that their whole thing, respecting the land, goes out the window, and they start burning it up, you know? And it's a difficult set piece to talk about. It's really mm-hmm. violent on both ends. There's cruelty each way. You know, you could say that it portrays whites or natives in a billion different ways, you know, based on this scene or the context. But I think what's most important here is the human drama, because we see Ward Bond running away from all these people. And we see Dana Andrews, the moral center of the movie, who says that a man should never be killed, never be hung, unless it is 1,000% certain, you know. Ward Bond tries to join in with them when they go on the attack, and he's just like, no. And they just watch Ward Bond get scalped and hammered to death. And then they shoot those natives who did that to him. And it's one of the most complicated chains of violence I've seen in a Hollywood movie in terms of how it makes you feel. It's very, mm-hmm. it's not that complicated in terms of why, what happened, you know, but like,
yeah,
it is very strange and difficult to watch. As are all of the scalpings. The scalpings in this are like hardcore. Like, Turner does not shy away from the violence in this at all. And I love that. about the film. I think that the violence in the last 10 minutes is what makes this film great, because otherwise it would be way too easy to romanticize it. You know, like it's so easy to watch a Turner Western or a Anthony Mann Western and, you know, have a really poetic letterboxed review, you know, just like, oh, you know, finding your love in a new world, you know, just you, the sand, the horse, and the banjo. But it's like this was like, no, this is about fucking brutal violence and basically the genocide that America did to the people who were here first. And it just coming in at the last 10 minutes and shoving that in your face is so smart, in my opinion, and is the structural trick up this movie's sleeve. We talked about an odd narrative structure, but I just think that it's the gut punch needed for a classic establishing a town type Western.
Well, it kind of like sneaks up on you, like you said, like it's kind of packed in the last 20 minutes. And it's, you know, it all comes from like the perspective of like the Dana Andrews characters, like the outsider. And yeah, it kind of reveals itself as the stuff that goes on that you don't consider, you don't think about. Yeah. And like, it's, you know, it's like the untold history. You know, it's like, yeah, we got the one part of, you know, Native Americans being savages in our history books. But, you know, we didn't get the part first where, you know, a Ward Bond like character, you know, provoked them or something like that. And yeah, it kind of all sneaking up on, because it like, you know, he, same with the George aspect of it, right? Like he doesn't suspect George at all. It's not even really on his mind. It all just kind of sneaks up on him. And it just shows that, yeah, like the building of these communities and like the building of America, it's kind of like a very complex thing. And obviously now we have the hindsight, you know, there was a very violent and, you know, a lot of bad stuff went into doing that. But like Turner in the 40s kind of just giving people that dose of reality, if you're being like, it's not all one sided here. Like this is, you know, this is a very complex thing. And the chain of violence that follows, it's very, you know, ahead of its time. And, you know, it delivers a complex message you'd find in like a revisionist Western.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on the ending, JT?
No, I loved it. I think throughout most of the film, it is recalling, I mean, Stars in My Crown comes later, mm-hmm. right? But it's sort of echoing that film's sort of peaceful quality, which makes sense because that film, like, I don't know, there's less of a, I mean, there is sort of the establishing the town, but there's like, and I mean, there is like lingering threats of violence throughout, because I don't think you can do the West and westward expansion without that. But this movie is just so much more about like just the like, I don't know, how that morality is like hanging in the fold, and that it is, I don't know, people can uphold justice and have this very strong sense of morals like Dana Andrews, but just like very, just as easily in like the same setting and in the same terms of like establishing a community could be just as nefarious and evil as Ward Bond. And I mean, I agree with what you're saying about like the complications that come from like the depiction of Native Americans here, that I think it's just like, I don't know, it's part of, I don't want to say the joy of it, but like when you're interrogating like films like this, particularly old Hollywood Westerns, even the most progressive, like obviously you're going to get like a hint of that. And I feel like that's what, I don't know, it's not the fun of it, but it's,
part of the complication.
It's the complications, and the complications are what makes it like a rich and piece of art.
Yeah. I mean, classic Hollywood wouldn't be my favorite, you know, realm of art in any medium if it wasn't so complicated.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of why it's like, it's never going to go down 1,000% easy. There's always going to be something that makes you a little disappointed in the film, even if it's the best film ever. It's like, oh man, that was going on back then, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Even if you're as like aware as like Turner appears to be of like the elements at play here, again, like it's, if something was made in the 40s, there is like a baseline level of racism that everyone involved would have.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, it's expected from audiences at the time going to see the Western. You know, if there wasn't a little bit of racism in it, people would be like,
they're walking out of the theaters.
Yeah, they're like the script doctor at whatever studios are like, you forgot to add the racism in here. Like, that has to be in here. You realize, right? Like, I haven't seen a Western escape that, really, from that era.
Yeah, it's hard to think of a Western that doesn't have a threat of natives at some point, no matter how idyllic and like closed into its own community it feels. Because there are a lot of Westerns that feel very much like that. Like Stars in My Crown, if you want to call it a Western, you know, which I guess doesn't have any Native American stuff, but it has, you know, like this film's relationship to World War II, it has American white supremacy and racism in it, you know, and the struggle of black Americans. And that's like the key to that movie. It's I actually think Stars in My Crown and this film share a lot of the same narrative DNA.
Totally.
Yeah. Stars in My Crown, it's like you start with Joel McRae being like the gun-toting pastor cowboy. It's like, what kind of movie am I going to watch? And then it's like, no, he's just a nice pastor, you know? And it's just like life lessons with a nice pastor. And then it's like a melodrama about a town illness. And then it becomes like a harrowing racism story, you know? And it's just one of the best films. But I really love Canyon Passage too. And I think, you know, if you're going classic clip mode, that's a great double feature. And you're out of there in less than 3 hours too. Rare for a double feature. But I feel like Turner's knack for stylization outside of the horror genre allows him to capture the idyllic quality that Hollywood Westerns were supposed to show as like the foundational myth of our country, while also getting into the darkness that is inescapable. You just scratched the shit out of me, dude. That was not cool, Boris.
Boris defends the Old West. It's like, actually, that was good. It wasn't racist. It's what needed to be done.
Stop your liberal revisionism. Blood needed to be shed.
Look, they had cats back then too, you know, who knows? Who knows if his grandpa, you know, his grandpa could have been a Nazi.
people do that, you know, for people, but it's like pets have racist relatives too. So some,
hey,
just
Sam Fuller forgot. Knew about that, you know.
Focus man in cat. America.
White dog, you know, it's a lot of people misinterpret that movie. The previous owner didn't train it. You just see like the dog from White Dog go to a pet cemetery and it's like barking at a grave and it's subtitled, "You did this, Dad."
I never wanted to be racist, but you made me.
Malcolm, any final thoughts on Canyon Passage and a rating?
I kind of feel like I said all I need to say. I'm going to give it 4 bullets. And, you know, we've mentioned it before. One of the most beautiful Westerns ever. Just, you know, it deserves that mention. Just a beautiful movie. JT, what about you?
Yeah, I'm going 4.5 bullets. I really love this one. Tournaire is really interesting. I feel like there is a subset of directors who, especially those that worked in like the Western genre, like Anthony Mann, that I feel like get their, like, obviously have received their flowers 20 times over by like hardcore cinephiles, but are still like the ones where it's just like, okay, after you've had like the big, you've had Hawks and Ford, you go into these other weird little avenues.
Yeah. Level 2.
Exactly. Yeah. And Tournaire is has some of my favorites in that realm. And I don't know. It's just a beautiful movie that unfolds with like a level of sinisterness that I feel like this is the second time I've seen it, but it always catches me by surprise.
Calling him level 2 just made me think of like Bill Simmons doing one of his pyramids for classic Hollywood directors. So I was texting House and I was asking him if Minnelli was level 1 or 2.
If Bill Simmons was into classic Hollywood, then we wouldn't even need to have a podcast.
You know? Yeah, no, that's it. Yeah. First of
all, you know what's crazy? Like, the fact that people don't watch old movies really fucking pisses me off. Like, classic Hollywood is the greatest thing ever, and everyone should be watching classic Hollywood movies. the fact that Larry David would be a regular guest on the Rewatchables if Bill Simmons did old movies drives me up the wall. I don't know if you know that. When Larry was on the Bill Simmons pod, he's like, yeah, I want to go on the Rewatchables, but you don't let me pick old movies.
What the fuck? Like,
you're telling Larry David?
You're telling Larry David no?
He can't choose. Like, he just put young Mr. Lincoln in the finale of Curb. Like,
yeah, that's crazy.
And you're
going to
tell him no? Larry David, greatest movie taste of any comedian of all time. I don't give a shit if you show me clips of Louis talking about Kubrick, you know? Larry David being a TCM god is like, that just warms my heart every day.
Comedians make fun of movies, too. They're kind of, you know, they have a contentious relationship, comedians and movies.
I got a little heated hearing Larry David make fun of Fear Strikes Out, starring Anthony Perkins. not actually. It was pretty funny. He was just talking about how bad Anthony Perkins was at pretending to play baseball, which is a very, you know, Larry David type thing to do. But that's a great movie. But anyway, I think that's going to do it for this week's extended clip.
Wait, did you drop a bullet rating?
No, I did not. I love this movie. I'm going 4 bullets on it. I think that it's among, you know, that classic Tornero level. I think there's the next level of the masterpieces, like Stars in My Crown, which is why I leave a little room for this one. But I think on a pure photographic level, it's easily the best work I've seen from him. And on a pure photographic level, I mean, how many Westerns are even close to this? It's like My Darling Clementine, which came out the same year. And in the 40s, at least, you know, I'm trying to think of a Western from the 40s that photographically reaches these heights other than My Darling Clementine, which is in a completely opposite approach visually, too, you know. I think that, you know, if we're giving out the Clip Awards, best cinematography in a Western, you know, the nominees are. But yeah, no, this is a 4 for me. I really love it. And I really love Jacques Tourneur. And I'm glad that we stole him from France, because it would be a shame if he was just making, you know, Vichy French propaganda.
Papa du cinéma, or cinéma du papa.
Oh, if he was making, cinéma du papa, let alone the fucking like Nazi propaganda he might have had to do.
Cinema du papas fritas, is that anything? Is that a joke? That's
yes, it is, Mel. Cinema du papas fritas is just like movies you eat french fries in.
Yeah, I guess, like,
so it's like Avengers and shit, like, movies where it's basically everything at the Alamo where they serve
fries at the movies. That's a rare combo. I feel like I never have,
only at the full kitchen places, which I hate. Yeah,
well, sometimes you sneak I've snuck a McDonald's in.
Sneak a couple fucking Carl's Jr. chicken sandwiches into the Regal in Granada Hills. Fucking fuck with me, you know? The Regal in Granada Hills, the OG sneak food there was nachos. Not the food, but a place called Nacho _S.
Ooh.
That used to be across the street where that Carl's Jr. is. And God, I just had like the worst wave of nostalgia like 2 days ago. I saw a picture of the Valley Relics Museum, and they have the fucking sign from Nachos. And it's like, damn, I want some low-grade Mexican food. Because that's like for LA, low-grade Mexican food, which would be the best Mexican food in Philadelphia by far. Anyway, that's Food Corner. That was Clip Corner. Are you going to talk about any other talk shows like we did on the last one? I don't think so. I think this one might be a little short episode because we got to go catch a movie. So that will be the Clip Promise. Malcolm, I'll look at you. I just want to stand up.
Yeah.
The Clip Promise will be that on the next episode, we will be talking about a couple new releases. That's not the main topic. I'm just saying there will be a Malcolm in the Middle, and I will talk about both the new films by Radu Jude and Bertrand Bonello. So we'll see you next time, fellas and lady. There's one lady who listens. bye.
Bye.
Oh, buttermilk sky, can't you see my little donkey and me? We're as happy as a Christmas tree, heading for the one I love. I'm going to pop her the question, that question. Do you, darling, do you do? It'll be easy, so easy, if I can only bank on you, oh, buttermilk sky.